In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. When Jesus says, the poor you will always have with you, he's not being cynical. He's being a realist. You might say he's being a futurist, if you can call the one who is deity and divine and providential to be a futurist. It's not really a stretch for him, right? But isn't it true that for most of human history, nearly every civilization has struggled to find a way either to reduce or eradicate entirely the grinding poverty that affects so many of its constituents? Haven't societies after societies been stymied to find some way to create the conditions to help some chart a path out of their poverty or to preempt that situation entirely? I mean, it, like few other, I don't know what you call it, few other phenomenon within human existence, poverty reaches into a philosophical domain and, of course, a political domain and, yes, a sociological domain and also a psychological domain. Poverty touches on all of those fields of inquiry, both to understand it and also to ameliorate it. But brothers and sisters, I think we would all admit that poverty has a spiritual dimension to it, that if we do not take that into account, we will never know how it shall be different or new or a thing of the past. This morning, we're going to conclude our short series on the Proverbs, looking for wisdom, by looking at, again, several texts, all of which have to do with God's concern for the weakest among us. And I think that the overriding thesis of these texts is to say this, that the way of the righteous is concern for the impoverished, period, full stop. The way of the righteous is concerned for the poor. We're going to look at these texts, and I think we're going to find three things. The shape of that concern, the ground for that concern, and the strength to express that concern. What is its shape? What is its ground? And where do we find the strength to walk in the way of the righteous? So would you stand and look at those insert, those texts on your insert from the Proverbs. Readings from the Proverbs, starting in chapter 14. Whoever despises his neighbor is a sinner, but blessed is he who is generous to the poor. Whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. The rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. Whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor. Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and rob of life those who rob them. A righteous man knows the rights of the poor. A wicked man does not understand such knowledge. The poor man and the oppressor meet together. The Lord gives light to the eyes of both. If a king faithfully judges the poor, his throne will be established forever. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. If you're going to talk about the shape of this concern for the poor, you're talking about three things. Who are we talking about when we're talking about the poor? By what means or mode is that concern expressed? But also, to what end are we out to express that concern? What's its goal? Who's it for, by what means, and to what end? That's what we're asking when we're considering what it means to have the shape of this concern. When it talks about the question of for whom this concern is expressed, the Proverbs uses two words that the ESV translates both as poor. Two Hebrew words, rosh and dal. They're essentially interchangeable in meaning, but they're both referring to those who find themselves destitute as a consequence of circumstances that are largely outside their control. It's in distinction to other references in the Proverbs of those who have become impoverished as a consequence of their habitual folly. You might remember from last week's sermon, we looked at Proverbs 24, where it talked about the sight of walking by the field of the sluggard, right? His field has been grown, it's been nourished, and then it's been neglected, and then he finds himself, what? In a state of poverty. And then it says, sort of as a principle at the end of that verse, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. The owner of that field is now impoverished, but on account of his own neglect. The texts that we're looking at this morning are defining the poor as those who have encountered, to some large extent, unsolicited and unpredictable calamity. A famine hits. The death of a patriarch of a family occurs, like we're accustomed to reading in the Old Testament, like, for instance, in the book of Ruth. In instances like that, one can suddenly become impoverished of means or of protection or of preservation, any number of those things. And it's that sort of haplessly impoverished that is primarily in the minds of these texts, not so much those who have made foolish choice after foolish choice. Now, that said, that is an important distinction to be made. The family who has lost everything in a fire versus the guy who's lost everything by playing the lottery, right? Two different scenarios, two different predicaments. And in that sense, that is kind of a no-brainer on who takes priority in the shape of this concern. But we also have to take into consideration that there are always two extenuating circumstances that force us to be careful in how we apply this distinction. For one, what you and I might initially perceive to be the cause of another's poverty and what really has caused that poverty may be worlds apart. And so it's only by a kind of patient analysis that that kind of assessment can be done, and therefore one has to be, if I may say, faithfully present unto somebody in that condition so that you can reconcile perception with reality. That's one circumstance you have to take into consideration. The other is this. It's virtually inarguable that many experiences of poverty are a function of both some unsound choices and also circumstances beyond their control, right? In fact, you can certainly envision some foolish choices coming in the wake of unfortunate circumstances, and it's just a function of desperation that leads them to do the dumb thing in order to rectify a situation that they find themselves in. And so while defining this constituency of this concern as the Proverbs do is important, the Proverbs themselves are forcing us to take into consideration each and every aspect of that predicament. That's who we're talking about in some respect, and though it's a nuanced vision, it's with that nuanced sense that we then have to turn to what it means to express this concern. What are the means by which we express that concern? Or you might consider it, what is the mode by which we express this concern? And you can boil it down into something that you will not find revolutionary. It will not be surprising for you to hear me say this. This concern comes in the form of generosity. And in a sense, it's twofold. Do no harm, and do unto others as you would be done unto yourself. In terms of doing no harm, the Proverbs here kind of lay out a spectrum of what it means to do no harm and what happens if you do harm. Look at back at 22, verses 16 and 22. It's the most scandalous side of the spectrum of doing harm. It says, "Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty." And then it says in verse 22, "Do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and rob of life those who rob them." That's pointed. Oppressing or robbing the poor, taking advantage of them being disadvantaged, of their ignorance or of their disenfranchisement, that's wicked, these texts say, and they go so far as to say that such behavior invites the same experience. But look at a little, maybe not quite so scandalous down the spectrum, when it says in 17:5, whoever mocks the poor, just mocks the poor, insults their maker. It's talking about just looking upon those who are in an impoverished situation with derision, maybe even with a jocularity about them. It's kind of like the schoolyard bully who laughs at the awkward stumblings of the local geek. They just sort of enjoy the fact that somebody else is suffering. That kind of attitude toward the poor is just as reprehensible in these texts' mind as oppressing them. But here's where it gets up in our business most. Look at what it says in 21:13. Of the ways of doing harm under the poor, this is the perhaps what we might think is the least scandalous, and yet listen to what it says in 21:13. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. Hear that again. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. Now, I'm pretty doubtful that any of you in this room are knowingly, consciously, perhaps even unconsciously, I'm doubtful that any of you are oppressing the poor or mocking anybody that's in a destitute circumstance. Brothers and sisters, this text is lopping even those of us who might be indifferent to the poor in the same category as those who are oppressing them. And that should be sobering to us all. Mere indifference, just ignoring those who are in a dire strait, is diametrically opposed to the shape of this concern. That's the do no harm part. What's the do good part? Again, it boils down to generosity. Look again at 19:17. Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. The word there for generous is the word chanan. It's from the root word chen, and it means to be gracious. It means to look with favor upon somebody else. It means to do them good for no other reason than that they have a need. And then in 22:9, it adds a little concreteness to the nature of that generosity when it kind of says, whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor. And that phrase, a bountiful eye, is a figure of speech, and it means one who is constitutionally generous, who is the kind of person that if you see a need, you spring into action. That's what it means to have a bountiful eye. And sharing bread is just one example of what it means to have a bountiful eye. This kind of attitudinal generosity is, like I mentioned earlier, is what we find in a book like the Book of Ruth. If you know that story at all, and we're going to look at Ruth in detail all the way next Advent, long time from now. We've got plenty of time to read it. But in the Book of Ruth, you see generosity happening all over the place. Ruth is generous to Naomi in promising to be of support to her when Naomi has lost her husband and her boys. Boaz is generous to Ruth in providing ample grain when Ruth and Naomi have nothing. Naomi is generous to Ruth in helping Ruth find someone who would provide for her long term. Generosity is all over the place in the midst of bitterness. And it's that kind of deep generosity that we all have to reflect on and to come to terms with. But let me bring forth an even more modern example of this kind of generosity. Her name is Michelle Nash, and I read about her last week in, of all articles, a Sports Illustrated column. Michelle Nash worked in a juvenile court serving at-risk youth who are between the ages of 18 and 21. Several years ago, she gets referred to a 15-year-old kid who, in his freshman year of prep school, walks out of class giving the middle finger to his professor, which sends him to the principal's office, which creates a litany of circumstances that he finds himself in a world of hurt. He gets referred to this counselor, this mentor of those who are at risk. This kid, he's 15, is the youngest of six. Single mom, no dad. He's bounced from house to house. The first time Michelle Nash meets this kid, she ends up weeping, because she looks down at his feet, and he's wearing flip-flops, and his feet are three sizes too bigger than his flip-flops, and so his toes are dragging the floor. And she cries at that level of need, and she takes him quickly to a shoe store and gets him some shoes. And then about a month into their mentor-mentee relationship, he calls her at 2:00 in the morning. He says, Michelle, I can't live like this anymore. It's dangerous what I'm doing. And she says, come stay the night with my husband and I. And so she opens a room, and She lets him sleep on an air mattress, and then eventually she says, you know what, this kid's got nothing. He's going to come live with us. And so she buys him a bed, and he looks at her, and he says, I've never had my own bed before. And she, again, walks out of the room and starts crying. Reflecting upon all that she has done for him, this kid says of her, Michelle gave me a different structure because when I lived with her, she could take things away. So who's this kid? His name is Cardale Jones, and he's the third-string quarterback for Ohio State, who led his team to the national championship in this town about a month ago. It's generosity. It's not what she was planning to do. It just kind of fell in her lap. And that's what it looks like. I'd like to say it was planned. It wasn't. It was unpredictable. That's the mode or the means of this concern. Now, you have to be careful here because generosity is being acclaimed and encouraged in these texts, and they should be. But generosity is not the goal. It's the means. Doing no harm and doing good is not the end of the matter. It's the means of the matter. So what is the goal of this concern for the poor? It's their flourishing. Cardale Jones is just one example of being provided for. He needed shoes. He needed a bed. He needed structure. He needed a chance. Not for the sake of a chance, but for the sake of what the chance might him afford the possibility of. The provision was for a purpose. These texts are enjoining all manner of generosity, but they're composed in the context of an Israelite setting, which was very familiar with the concept of shalom. And I have referenced that phrase before. You and I tend to think of it sort of in a reductionistic way. We do think of it in terms of peace. But it's a far more expansive term. It's talking about wholeness and fullness. It's talking about flourishing. Shalom is the goal of this concern. And it's an implicit goal, I know. And it's so implicit that you might think it's not even worth restating. We get that. But you have to factor in the goal of the shape of this concern. Otherwise, you run the risk of just contenting yourselves with being generous. You can lavish somebody with all manner of things. But if it's not ultimately ordered to their flourishing, then the generosity is in some sense more harm than good. And so a widely read and respected book in recent years was written, co-authored by two guys named Brian Fickert and Steve Corbett. They wrote a book called When Helping Hurts. After years of serving those in a variety of impoverished conditions, they had come to see that so many forms of well-meaning assistance actually exacerbated the problem. And they argue that if you reduce the need of the poor to the material, if you just see their condition as one in primarily physical terms, you don't tend to understand underlying causes and you risk doing more to alienating them than helping them. And so the authors write, more than ensuring that people have enough material things, caring for the poor includes the harder task of empowering people to earn what they need through their own labor. Now, you got to read the whole book, and I haven't. I've just read reviews of the book to kind of get the full comprehensive picture of what they're arguing for. But they're all making the same point. The goal of this concern is not just to get them out of a constant state of deprivation and uncertainty and dependent. It's to help them reach a position when they too are able to give of themselves unto others who have a need. That's slow. And it's complicated. And there are people in this room who do this kind of work every day and know full well that a lot of effort comes to naught. But it doesn't excuse us from the command and the privilege. All of our efforts to conform to the shape of this concern requires that we think in terms of goals, not just in means. Now, everything that I've said so far is perhaps to you pretty unremarkable. It would stuff that you would expect me to hear, but we got to drill down a little bit more into the ground of this concern. You've heard about the shape. Now, what's the basis for it? What's the rationale? And that rationale, that ground, has got two parts, and one of which is the most obvious of them all, and it's this. God is on the side of the poor, period. The whole spate of texts that we've just read enjoining us to care for the poor should be clear substantiation for that claim. It's more explicit in what we've heard in 22:22, where it says, "Do not rob the poor, for the Lord himself will plead their cause." He's their advocate. He's the one who comes to their defense. He's the one who will intervene and even take vengeance upon those who defraud the poor. Which at this point, we got to kind of stop here, because it's inevitable that at least 14 of you in this room, probably 14, maybe more, maybe less, who may be wondering to ask, okay, if God is really for the poor, then why are they poor? If he were really their advocate, they wouldn't be poor, right? It's a reasonable question. It's a legitimate question on its face. It's almost a species of the larger question that we tend to ask about any kind of calamity in this world when we say, if God is so good and powerful, why is there so much evil? Right? Now, the question of why people are poor comes from the same urge to ask, why are there budding students in North Carolina who get gunned down for reasons that might have something to do with a parking space and might have something to do with a religious outlook? Why does that happen? It's the same question, just in a different form. And it's problematic to offer reasons about particular incidents. It's even problematic to raise this question in the course of a 25-minute sermon. But we do have to answer it somewhat. And the way we answer that reasonable question is, first of all, to say this. Part of the reason for poverty in this world is on account of sin. Personal, structural, institutional, cultural sin. It's there because sin is here, period. And some are caught in poverty's jaws, even though God is at work to overturn their condition. But to the question about whether God is even present and whether he's really for the poor, given how many poor there is, though one may be poor in a material sense, that does not strictly correlate to a spiritual poverty. You and I know full well that there are people who have very little materially, but who have much love and faith. And we also know the converse of that reality too, that there are some who have so much, but who love so little. And so that paradox, though, it doesn't exempt us from seeking to champion the cause of those who are destitute, but it does at least answer in part, just a little bit, the objection that if you're poor, that means you're cursed of God or that God isn't present. Because oftentimes it's in one's material lack where one becomes all the more acquainted with and familiar and sensible and sensitive to the presence of God. God is on the side of the poor because he is their advocate. He's also on their side in the sense that he identifies with them. He's not just defending them. He's there with them. It says, whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. To ridicule somebody who's destitute is to wag your finger not just at them, it's to wag your finger at God himself. And who are you to do that? He so identifies with those who are in lack that to mistreat them is in some sense to mistreat God. And conversely, those who are generous to the poor are actually lending to the Lord. That's what it says in 19:7. Deriding the poor is deriding God, but giving to the poor is simultaneously giving to God. You've heard that before. Jesus says as much in Matthew 25, where he summarizes, when you feed and clothe and visit the least of these, you're doing it unto him. And when you refuse to do that, you're also not doing it unto him. When you fail to feed, clothe, and visit the least, it's as if you've rebuffed not some smelly, unkempt guy on the street. It's as if you've rebuffed the Lord of the universe. He's on the side of the poor. That's the first ground of this concern. The second is a little bit more ironic. You're on the side of the poor. I'm on the side of the poor, in a sort of a double entendre kind of sense. We just heard in 22:2, how to mock the poor is to insult your maker. The rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. When it uses that phrase that rich and poor meet together, the Proverbs are reminding us of an indissoluble reality that yours and ours socioeconomic distinctions tend to forget. And that reality is that we all share a common origin. We all share a common identity, regardless of our 1040. The economic disparity doesn't erase the foundational commonality that we are all utterly dependent for life and light and all else upon the one who is responsible for all that is, otherwise known as the Maker. Not long before Job is confronted by no less than God himself, in chapter 31, he is again trying to figure out what has led him to his dire strait. And he sort of makes himself vulnerable before God and all of those who are listening to him. And in chapter 31, he says, "If I have rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb?" Job is expressing what these proverbs are out to remind us, that though we might be led to perceive someone of lower rank and station in human terms as somebody who's other, in point of fact, they are us. We are they. And were it not for manifold forces and events that were well outside of our control, our respective circumstances might be entirely inverted. And so we're on the side of the poor in the sense that we all share a common identity. And we're also on the side of the poor because that common origin and identity means that we have a common interest. We're all interested in flourishing. We're interested in ours, which means we're interested in theirs. Because we are of the same flesh, it says in Deuteronomy 17. We all have a common interest in flourishing. Our destiny is bound up with the plight of those who are destitute because our identity is bound up with them. We are all beneficiaries of grace. And so when Tim Keller says, if you look down at the poor or stay aloof from their suffering, you've not really understood or experienced God's grace. And if the church does not identify with the marginalized, it will itself be marginalized. That's God's poetic justice. I still haven't said anything you probably disagree with. Maybe be uncomfortable in front of. Maybe want to chafe at in a private kind of way. But you might not disagree with it or could make a case against it. That said, if I know me, I know that while it doesn't take much to nod at the platitudes of a sermon, it does take strength to enact this kind of concern with care and courage and compassion and most of all consistency. So what's it going to take? And where do we go from here? Here's my last point. Where do we find the strength for this kind of concern? Now, by strength, I don't mean some kind of magical force that rises up within you. By strength, I mostly mean something that overcomes our hesitancies to follow the shape of this concern on the ground of this concern. Jonathan Edwards gave a sermon on the passage from Deuteronomy 15 that was in our affirmation of faith. You think my sermons are long? Sit with one of his. As any good preacher likes to do, he likes to anticipate objections to that which he shares. And he came up with 11 objections to why somebody might feel disinclined to be charitable to those who are impoverished. I'm not going to share all 11. I'm going to give you two that I think live in our world about why we might be hesitant to give aid to those who are destitute. One is this. You may have helped somebody before and it came to nothing. And you might have even gotten burned as a consequence of it. And you think, not again, not going to do it. And the other reason you might not want to be helpful is because you think, you know what, they're in this condition because it's their fault. And if I help out, I'm not helping. I'm really exacerbating the problem. They did this. They need to get their way out of it. Those are real world sources of hesitation that you and I may not admit to, but probably suffer from time to time. If the shape and the ground of concern are as clear as day, then what's going to overcome those hesitancies? The author of Proverbs didn't know it when he said in 1917, "Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord and will repay him for his deed." What he didn't know when he wrote those words is that he was unwittingly anticipating the one who would be ultimately gracious for the good of those who are in a desperate strait, and God rewarded him for it. I'm talking about Jesus. In coming to earth to die for sin, Jesus Christ offers the most profound example of impoverishing himself for the sake of bringing flourishing in an eternal sense to everybody who is poor unto him. As Paul puts it in Philippians 2, Jesus did not consider his divine nature as something to be held onto, as some sort of hedge against entering into the conditions of those who are weak and frail and hostile. Instead, he entered into human limitations. He took on weakness. He denied himself everything that was due himself, also that he might provide us the lasting treasure of his steadfast love. That's making himself poor, that others might be rich. He experienced hunger. He went into an experience of homelessness. He was hassled and harangued wherever he traveled, and he felt that kind of impoverishment to win spiritual enrichment for anybody that would follow him. He is an example. And in enriching us with God, he wasn't simply limiting his interest to the spiritual dimension. Practically his first sermon in Luke chapter 4, when he's in the synagogue, he reads from Isaiah and he says in that little speech, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." This good news was of a kingdom that was coming in him that would be inaugurated by his death, and thereby bring pardon for sin to all who would run to refuge in him. But that sermon also had to do with alleviating material issues and calling those who would follow on him to work for that same effort. His interest was and is in all things being made new, both spiritual and material. Soul poverty and material poverty overturned in him through his words and his deeds. He's our example. But he's also our motivation, brothers and sisters. Because look, if you're cynical that all of your help has never seemed to help, you have to realize that Jesus spent himself in innumerable ways that didn't pan out or bear fruit. And so you have to ask yourself, do you have more reason to be frugal with what you have than Jesus did? As Jonathan Edwards put it, It is better to give to several that are not true objects of charity than to send away empty one that is. If you're going to err on the side of generosity, if you're going to err on the side of anything, let it be on the generous side, right? Are you concerned that rendering aid to someone who's at fault for their predicament will make things worse? It's a legitimate question. And to be sure, to help someone consistently who refuses to take wisdom to be able to see a different predicament, you're right, it is harmful. But if you start boiling down the offer of assistance on the front end to the claim that they are undeserving of your concern, then you have to ask yourself this: were you deserving of the grace shown you in Jesus? Had you made all the right choices to provoke his kindness? Or were you the sheer beneficiary of unmerited kindness? You know the answer to that question. And the answer to that question has to shape your initial concern for anybody you encounter. Edwards knows in his sermon that there are people that are genuinely at fault for their plight. But he, in the same breath, knows that there are some in that plight simply because they just don't know any better. And in neither an at-fault or a no-fault situation are we entirely relieved of responsibility and the privilege to give. We are called to help. And then only after they refuse to make necessary changes that would help improve things do you then even consider the option of withholding help, as if only to be of help to them. Our poverty provoked the Lord's extravagance, and that has to be the shape and motivation for ours. Okay, let me land this plane. This concern for the poor, its shape, its ground, its strength, it's so open-ended, it's almost too unwieldy to talk about. So if you will, let me boil it down to something just a little bit more concrete, just a little toehold to begin the ascent to the task of enacting this concern. Concern for the poor is something that you and I will all do individually, but I want to end with an application for us to think in collective terms as a church, as a people of God. And so I want to offer you three very brief applications for you to apply as CTK. And the first of which is this. I would like for you to pray for 40 days during Lent. It starts next Wednesday. Next Wednesday is Ash Wednesday. And it's 40 days until Easter. And I'm going to ask you to pray, and I'm going to ask me to pray that God would show us how we as a church can begin to live into this calling together and collectively. It will be what it means to be faithfully present to our world if we begin to answer that call in some sort of collective sense. Two, I'm going to ask you this. Several of you in this community are already part of relief efforts, of ministries aplenty, in a variety of circumstances, some of which have explicit reference to those who are destitute, and some of which it's more tangential. Regardless, I want you to do me a favor if you're already part of a ministry in our church. I want you to email Imelda with that information. I want you to tell us, what are you already a part of in some sort of structured way, whether it's in a paid way or a volunteer way? We want to know that. Because we want to know, is there some other way that other members of our community could come and become a partner with you in that effort? Instead of starting from ground zero, starting by reinventing the wheel at every time, what's already at work in our midst that others of us might become a partner with? Thirdly and finally, as you're praying over these next 40 days, I would like you to consider, many of you in this room, that you might become part of something that the session has discussed in a very theoretical fashion for a long time, but something that we're ready to start taking some concrete steps toward. We have begun to sketch the broad contours of this, but only it's very incipient right now. But in time, we would like to see something formed called the Diaconal Cohort, the DC. Everybody likes acronyms. The Diaconal Cohort is going to be a body of men and women in this community who have a heart to extend mercy, both within our church and without it. It's going to work with our elders and our future deacons to help imagine and coordinate efforts unto that end. It's going to help our whole community practice the shape of this concern somewhat for the poor. It's not the only thing that they'll be doing, but it'll be a big part of what they're doing. And so if you have the slightest interest in helping us as a church to give shape to this concern, I would like you to consider applying to be part of this cohort. That's about as much as I know about this cohort right now. We're going to talk about it a lot tomorrow night at our session meeting. But I want to put that idea in your heads now so that when the time comes and we say, who would like to consider being part of this and being trained for it, that you have already gotten a whisper in your ear that maybe it's your turn. Brothers and sisters, the poor we are always going to have with us. But by him who became poor so that we might become rich, we find the strength that's going to help others flourish. Until that time when not only death shall be no more, but when poverty shall be no more. It will take God to do it. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.